you'll find it easier to start. Goal setting. Simply figuring out how to motivate myself wasn't always enough, however. Writing a book is a big goal, too big in many ways to grasp the entirety of it at first. In trying to figure out how to wrap my head around the objective, I was helped enormously by the reporting I conducted regarding goal setting. The big takeaway was that I needed two kinds of aims. I needed a stretch goal, something to spark big ambitions. And I needed a SMART goal to help me form a concrete plan. One of the most effective ways to formulate both objectives, experts told me, is through a specific kind of to-do list. I needed to write out my goals, but in a way that forced me to identify my stretch objectives and my SMART aims. So I began writing to-do lists, and at the top of each one, I wrote my overarching ambition, what I was working toward in the long term. That helped me avoid the need for cognitive closure that can force us to become obsessed with short-term, easy-to-achieve goals. And then underneath, I described a sub-goal and all its SMART components, which forced me to come up with a plan, which, in turn, made it more likely that all my goals would be achieved. One of my stretch goals in reporting this book, for instance, was to find a story that illustrated how mental models worked. I knew that aviation experts felt that mental models played an important role in how pilots responded to emergencies. And so, at the top of my to-do list for this chapter, I wrote, Chapter 3 To-Do. Stretch. Find aviation story, narrowly averted crash, that demonstrates mental models. Then, below that stretch goal, I wrote my SMART goals related to that big ambition. Specific. Locate an aviation expert by researching academic papers on Google Scholar. Measurable. Call 4 experts each morning until I find the right person story. Achievable. Clear my morning schedule to focus on this task and turn off email from 9 o'clock to 11:30. Realistic. On Monday, spend an hour researching aviation experts and creating a call list. Rank those experts, and, by 10:15, begin my 4 calls of the day. At the end of each conversation, ask them to recommend other experts to call. Timeline. If I do 4 calls a day, then I should have made at least 16 calls by Thursday. If I haven't found the perfect story by Thursday, I'll come up with a new plan. If I do find the right story, I'll send a synopsis to my editor on Friday. It took only a few minutes to jot down these stretch and SMART goals, but it made a huge difference in how much I got done that week. Now I create a similar to-do list for every big task, and as a result, I know exactly what to do when I sit at my desk each morning. Instead of having to make decisions and running the risks of distraction, I have a clear sense of how to proceed. In addition, because I'm always being reminded of my stretch goal, I don't get easily sidetracked or captured by the need to simply check things off of my list. As scientists might say, I've muted my craving for cognitive closure. I don't stop working merely because I had a good interview or because I found a helpful study, or because I found an interesting narrative that might go in the book. Instead, I'm always reminded that I'm chasing SMART goals for a bigger reason. To find the perfect story, or finish a chapter, or write a book. In fact, I have a whole series of stretch goals to remind me of my grander ambitions. Chapter 3. Stretch. Explain mental models. Stretch. Open with Air France 447. Explain why it crashed. Stretch. Explain cognitive tunneling. Stretch. Find a plane crash that was averted. Stretch. Find a study that explains mental models in everyday workplace. To set goals, choose a stretch goal, an ambition that reflects your biggest aspirations. Then, break that into sub-goals and develop SMART objectives. Focus. This being real life, however, there are always distractions and other demands competing for my attention. And so, in addition to having a plan, I needed to work on maintaining my focus. There's a key insight from the chapter about the averted aviation disaster of Qantas Flight 32 that I have tried to keep in mind. We aid our focus by building mental models, telling ourselves stories about what we expect to see. To make sure I stayed focused on my stretch and SMART goals, I had to envision what I expected to happen when I sat down at my desk each morning. And so, every Sunday night, I got into a habit of taking a few moments with a pad and pen to imagine what the next day and week ought to look like. I usually chose three or four things I wanted to make sure happened and made myself answer a series of questions. My goal: find an aviation story that illustrates mental models. What will happen first? I'll compile a list of aviation experts. What distractions are likely to occur? There will be a ton of emails waiting. How will you handle that distraction? I won't check my email account until 11:30. How will you know you've succeeded? I'll have made at least 10 calls and spoken to 4 aviation experts. What is necessary for success? I'll need a cup of coffee so I'm not tempted to get up. What will you do next? I'll research leads and prepare a call list for the next day. It typically takes only a few minutes to envision what I hope will occur, but by the end of this exercise, I have a story in my mind, a mental model of how my morning should proceed. And, as a result, when distractions inevitably arise, it's easier to decide, in the moment, whether they deserve my focus or can be ignored. If my email account says there are 30 new messages, I know that I should ignore them until 11:30, because that's what the story inside my head tells me to do. If the phone rings and caller ID indicates it's an expert I'm trying to contact, I'll take the call, because that interruption has a place within my mental model. I have a stretch goal and a SMART goal that give me a plan, and a picture inside my head of how that plan is supposed to unfold, so making the choices that shape focus is much easier. To stay focused, envision what will happen. What will occur first? What are potential obstacles? How will you preempt them? Telling yourself a story about what you expect to occur makes it easier to decide where your focus should go when your plan encounters real life. Decision making. I had worked on coming up with stretch goals and SMART objectives. I had a mental model to stay focused. I had found ways to improve my motivation. Despite all that, however, every so often something came along that would blow my well-crafted intentions apart. Sometimes it was small, like my wife asking if I wanted to get lunch together. Sometimes it was big, like an editor asking me to take on an exciting but unplanned assignment. So how should I make a decision when confronted with the unexpected? Perhaps there was a valuable insight in the chapter on probabilistic thinking. Envision multiple futures, and then force myself to figure out which ones are most likely and why. For a simple decision like whether I should meet my wife for lunch, the calculus is easy. In one potential future, I take an hour for lunch and come back happy and relaxed. In another, lunch goes long and we spend most of it discussing family logistics and babysitter problems, and when I get back to my desk, I'm fried and behind schedule. By thinking through potential futures, I was better prepared to influence which of those futures would actually occur. When choosing a restaurant to meet my wife, for instance, I suggested one close to my office so I could make it back to my desk quickly. When family logistics came up during lunch, I asked my wife to wait until that evening to talk calendars. By anticipating the future, I was better prepared to make wiser decisions. But bigger decisions, such as whether to take on an exciting new writing assignment, require a bit more analysis. Midway through writing this book, for instance, a production company asked if I was interested in developing a TV show. To decide if I should pursue that opportunity, which would delay my reporting but might pay off in the long run, I wrote out a few potential futures of what might happen if I worked on writing a show. Future 1. I spend a lot of time working and my show goes nowhere. Future 2. I spend a lot of time working and my show is a hit. Future 3. I spend a modest amount of time working and my show goes nowhere. Future 4. I spend a modest amount of time working and my show is a hit. I had no idea how to evaluate these potential futures. I knew there were dozens of other possibilities I should be considering, but couldn't anticipate. And so I called some friends in television. Based on those conversations, I assigned each scenario a rough probability. Future 1, 45% probability. Because you can pour a lot of time into a show, but most never succeed. Future 2, 5% probability. Because even though most shows go nowhere, you never know. Future 3, 45% probability. Because I can control how much time I invest if I plan wisely. Future 4, 5% probability. Because, who knows? Based on the estimations of professionals, it seemed most possible that if I invested a lot of time, it wasn't likely to pay off. But if I invested a modest amount of time, there was a likelihood I would learn something, if nothing else. At that point, I wanted to let my Bayesian instincts guide me, and so I spent a few days letting my imagination play with various outcomes. In the end, I decided that there was another potential future I was ignoring. That even if this show never materialized, I might have a lot of fun. So I decided to commit, but I specified up front that I wanted my participation to be modest. It was a great decision. All told, my involvement in the project was small, probably the equivalent of 2 weeks. But the payoffs have exceeded my expectations. The show will premiere this fall, and I've learned a lot working on it. What's most important, however, is that I made this decision in a deliberate way. Because I had anticipated various possibilities about what might occur, and, in fact, had drawn up some stretch and SMART goals before joining the project, I was able to manage my involvement. To make better decisions, envision multiple futures. By pushing yourself to imagine various possibilities, some of which might be contradictory, you're better equipped to make wise choices. We can hone our Bayesian instincts by seeking out different experiences, perspectives, and other people's ideas. By finding information and then letting ourselves sit with it, options become clearer. The big idea. This appendix offers a quick overview of a few key concepts that have been meaningful in my own day-to-day life. If you can become more motivated, more focused, better at setting goals and making good decisions, then you're a long way down the path to becoming more productive. There are, of course, other ideas in this book that also help when we are managing other people, when we are trying to learn faster, when we need to innovate faster. Each of those areas of productivity have their own insights as well. To make teams more effective, manage the how, not the who, of teams. Psychological safety emerges when everyone feels like they can speak in roughly equal measure, and when teammates show they are sensitive to how each other feel. If you are leading a team, think about the message your choices reveal. Are you encouraging equality in speaking or rewarding the loudest people? Are you showing you are listening by repeating what people say and replying to questions and thoughts? Are you demonstrating sensitivity by reacting when someone seems upset or flustered? Are you showcasing that sensitivity so other people will follow your lead? To manage others productively, lean and agile management techniques tell us employees work smarter and better when they believe they have more decision-making authority and when they believe their colleagues are committed to their success. By pushing decision-making to whoever is closest to a problem, managers take advantage of everyone's expertise and unlock innovation. A sense of control can fuel motivation, but for that drive to produce insights and solutions, people need to know their suggestions won't be ignored and that their mistakes won't be held against them. To encourage innovation, creativity often emerges by combining old ideas in new ways, and innovation brokers are key. To become a broker yourself and encourage brokerage within your organization, be sensitive to your own experiences. Paying attention to how things make you think and feel is how we distinguish clichés from real insights. Study your own emotional reactions. Recognize that the stress that emerges amid the creative process isn't a sign everything is falling apart. Rather, creative desperation is often critical. Anxiety can be what often pushes us to see old ideas in new ways. Finally, remember that the relief accompanying a creative breakthrough, while sweet, can also blind us to alternatives. By forcing ourselves to critique what we've already done, by making ourselves look at it from different perspectives, by giving new authority to someone who didn't have it before, we retain clear eyes. To absorb data better, when we encounter new information, we should force ourselves to do something with it. Write yourself a note explaining what you just learned, or figure out a small way to test an idea, or graph a series of data points onto a piece of paper, or force yourself to explain an idea to a friend. Every choice we make in life is an experiment. The trick is getting ourselves to see the data embedded in those decisions, and then to use it somehow so we learn from it. What's most important throughout all these concepts is the foundational idea undergirding these lessons, the tissue that connects the 8 insights at the heart of this book. Productivity is about recognizing choices that other people often overlook. It's about making certain decisions in certain ways. The way we choose to see our own lives, the stories we tell ourselves, and the goals we push ourselves to spell out in detail. The culture we establish among teammates. The ways we frame our choices and manage the information in our lives. Productive people and companies force themselves to make choices most other people are content to ignore. Productivity emerges when people push themselves to think differently. When I was working on this book, I came upon a story that I loved, one of my favorite bits of reporting. The tale involved Malcolm McLean, the man who essentially created the modern shipping container. McLean died in 2001, but he left behind videotapes and numerous records, and I spent months reading about him, as well as interviewing members of his family and dozens of his former colleagues. They described a man who had relentlessly chased an idea, that shipping goods inside of big metal boxes would make docks more productive, and how that insight eventually transformed manufacturing, the transportation industry, and the economies of whole continents. They explained that McLean was so productive because he was fanatically obsessed with a single idea. I devoted many, many hours to learning about McLean. I wrote several drafts of his story, determined to fit it into this book. In the end, however, none of them worked. The lesson he offered, that a single-minded devotion to an idea can spur massive change, turned out not to be as universal and important as the other concepts I wanted to explain. McLean's story was interesting, but not vital. What worked for him doesn't work for everyone. There are lots of examples where fanatical devotion has backfired. His insight wasn't big enough to be included among the other 8 ideas in this book. And yet the time I spent researching McLean was worth it, because discarding that work helped me understand the mechanics of focus. My mental model of this book kept conflicting with what I was learning about McLean. My SMART plan for the McLean story didn't match up with my stretch goal of describing universally applicable lessons. In other words, researching McLean helped me figure out what this book was supposed to be about. It served as a valuable reminder of how productivity actually functions. Productivity doesn't mean that every action is efficient. It doesn't mean that waste never occurs. In fact, as Disney learned, sometimes you have to foster tension to encourage creativity. Sometimes a misstep is the most important footfall along the path to success. But in the end, if you learn how to recognize certain choices that, to many, might not be obvious, then you can become smarter, faster, and better over time. Anyone can become more creative, more focused, better at framing their goals and making wise decisions. Schools can be transformed by changing how people absorb data. Teams can be taught how to learn more from mistakes, or use tension to their advantage, or make what seems like misspent hours into lessons getting them closer to their goals. Schools can be remade by empowering the people closest to a problem. The lives of senior citizens can be remade by teaching them to become subversives. We can all become more productive. Now you know how to start. This is Mike Chamberlain. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Smarter, Faster, Better, The Secrets of Being Productive in Life and Business by Charles Duhigg. This program was directed by Christina Rooney. Executive producer, Janet Stark. Text copyright 2016 by Charles Duhigg. Production copyright 2016, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.